This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the US Constitution, why it's important and how it's interpreted, with UCF Political Science Professor Aubrey Jewett and Barry University Law Professor Yang Nagov. Yang, let's come back to the US Constitution. I mean, it was written more than 200 years ago. How hard must it have been to write that document and know that it could endure through different political eras, still be relevant hundreds of years later? And there must be some parts of it, must there not, that maybe either are obsolete or need updating?
What's interesting about the Constitution is that, for the most part, the Constitution seems quite relevant to what is happening in society and as society changes. I think the one thing that comes to mind in terms of what in the Constitution might seem obsolete, and luckily so, it's a good thing that it's obsolete, is the Third Amendment with the quartering the soldiers, right? So historically, you had the military, the militia taking over people's homes. And luckily, we don't have that. But that was written in place to protect us from the public, the people from that happening. And that's one amendment that we haven't seen asserted, thankfully. And so that's a good thing that we don't have to have that asserted. What's also interesting is that while some may become or seem obsolete for the better, other amendments which we haven't seen a lot of play with has become more relevant and or used differently. And so in that way, the Constitution keeps up with the times because the Constitution is evolving as how we're thinking of using the Constitution as a way to protect our individual rights on whichever aisle side of the aisle you're on.
Right. And thinking about that, the Supreme Court is a significant lever in the interpretation of that, right? Just talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So when the country was formed, the Supreme Court was a very undefined branch. And Marbury versus Madison, which is the seminal case that outlines in which the court reaches out, goes out of its way to declare the power of the courts to emphatically define and interpret the law. And so that was the seminal case in which the court carved out its power. Through the years, then, the court has exercised that. And then we've seen a development in the court's jurisprudence where the court steps back and decides, ironically, that although it has the power to decide, it decides it doesn't want to decide cases. And that's a doctrine called the political question doctrine, in which you have all the ingredients that satisfy bringing a case before the court. And the court has the jurisdiction to review it, and yet it decides not to.
Does that happen very often?
It's happening more. And so the problem with that is even though the court has the power to interpret the law, it on its own has written these rules where it says under these conditions, we will not decide the cases. And so it's curbed its own power.
And so it's what, kicking those cases back to lower courts?
And there's no decision. There's no definitive answer for the litigant. So it doesn't get kicked back. The case ends at the Supreme Court where the court says we're not going to decide this, for instance, if it's a political question. And then that doctrine was developed to help the court avoid the political messiness of being referee, which is interesting because you would think the court's role is to referee between the two branches. But this doctrine was developed by the court as a means to extricate itself from the political tension between the two branches. And so when the court exercises this doctrine, there is no substantive answer. So you have just the status quo of the litigants continuing on because the court doesn't say who's right and who's wrong. The court says we're not answering the question. And we're actually seeing that in play here, particularly with this administration, as the boundaries of the Constitution get pushed. For example, during the impeachment, the question of may President Trump direct his executive officials not to answer or appear for the congressional hearings under subpoena. And one of the witnesses had initiated a court proceeding and then pulled back. And when the litigant or the witness had pulled that back, and I think it was McVaney, we no longer...
Mulvaney?
Yes, yes. We no longer have an opportunity for the court to answer that question because he voluntarily withdrew that case. And so as a matter of constitutional law, we don't know yet whether the court would say that witnesses must come before Congress under subpoena when they're issued a lawful subpoena. So the only answer we're going to get is from this impeachment. And so what's interesting is rather than the court interpreting what the Constitution means in this area of law, it's going to be the legislative branch deciding between their separation of powers what it means and what Congress can do to have accountability.
Aubrey Jewett, it's kind of thinking about the impeachment hearings in the House of Representatives. They have thrown a spotlight on the Constitution. Do they also, to you, reveal kind of more about the differences in how people interpret that Constitution and maybe the pressure that those differences are putting on this document?
Well, certainly impeachment does bring up some basic fundamental questions about separation of powers and about checks and balances, really, and checks and balances between the Congress and the President, and as we see right now, between the two branches or between the two bodies within Congress itself, the House and the Senate, who are not on the same page on this impeachment at all. And what we have seen, of course, with our current situation with President Trump, we have seen at least to some degree in previous impeachment proceedings as well. With President Clinton and before that with President Nixon, or really even going back all the way to President Johnson after the Civil War. Some of these questions have been discussed, for instance, whether or not there is such a thing as executive privilege, meaning can the executive branch refuse to have witnesses come to Congress, or can they refuse to turn over documents or tapes in the Nixon case that Congress has requested. And, you know, my take on it, I'm not a constitutional law professor, but my take on it is that, you know, basically what the Supreme Court has said is that there is such a thing as executive privilege, but there are limits to it. And so, for instance, in the Nixon case, President Nixon did not want to turn over his tape recordings of his private conversations from the White House to Congress, but the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 that he had to turn them over as part of that Watergate hearing. And, of course, once Congress got to hear those tapes, they heard the president talking about obstructing justice, basically covering up the Watergate break-in. And that was what turned that impeachment proceeding from a very partisan one to an actually very bipartisan one and forced the president eventually to resign before he was formally impeached because he saw it was coming and he saw that he was almost certainly going to get removed from office on a bipartisan vote. You know, on this one, I thought it was interesting that the House seemed to be in a little bit of a rush. I mean, honestly, you know, the sort of the political timing, I think, was important to them as much as the, you know, the sort of the legal strength of their case. And they did not want to seem to, you know, go down that route of trying to force some of the president's people to testify by going to the Supreme Court because it could take a few weeks or a month or two before all that unwound. And so instead, they just pushed ahead. And now, of course, Nancy Pelosi has said that she doesn't want to, or I shouldn't say she's not going to want to, but she has just, as of this minute, has not sent forth the articles of impeachment to the Senate, sort of leaving everything in limbo. Mm. And the Senate now saying, okay, well, not sure what we're going to do at this point. So, you know, for the minute, they're all just going to break for the holidays and it'll all just sort of be hanging there, I guess.
Professor Yang Nagar, what do you think the big constitutional battles will be for the future?
The one that will always remain a battle is so controversial, the Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. With each administration, the more conservative administrations will maybe run on trying to overturn that. Tied with that, and it's received a lot more prominence as our views on LGBT rights have changed, how LGBT rights are being interpreted for instance, unisex bathrooms in schools, may kids use the bathrooms of other gender, that's becoming more prominent an issue. And so these types of issues, which probably were not anticipated by our framers, are going to be battles. Religion, how religion gets used now as a sword, I think will continue to be a battle. And then gerrymandering, the districting of lines for voters. The Supreme Court says you can't gerrymander based on race, so that's entirely unconstitutional. But what the court has never answered, because it's labeled it a political question, is can you gerrymander based on political affiliation? And so that's going to continue to be a battle. And one final, as we see in this administration, is the separation of powers between the executive and legislative. There are certain battles that the court can't answer. Mm-hmm. For instance, with the impeachment, the internal rules, the court has held it's a political question. The court is not going to decide substantively whether an impeachment trial has happened in a particular way that it's supposed to happen. The court has said in a prior case, ironically, in the case of Judge Nixon, that it's a political question because the branches have their delineated powers, or the House and the Senate. The court won't touch that. It may touch, if the litigation had happened, the subpoena issue, because that happens with the accountability. But as in terms of the internal rules, the power play between the executive and legislative branch, until someone brings it up as litigation, that's just going to be pushed to the envelope until one side begins to, you know, it's a blinking contest. And until one side gives up, or one side says, I'm going to go to the court. And so that's probably going to be the biggest struggle that we're going to see in terms of any administration.
And that was Barry University Associate Professor of Law Yang Nagov and UCF Political Science Professor Aubrey Jewett. After the break, a reading of the US Constitution. We're back in a minute.